The title for this session is A Life That Triumphs Over Evil, but to be completely candid, it's a bit different for me. I wrestled with this more than I typically do in preparing a talk. I'm sure most of you know, at least, that my mom went to heaven this week. And I would like to, on behalf of myself and my whole family, to say thank you for the many, many of you who have expressed your kindness and your condolences and offered support and encouragement. You made this week really a celebration of a life, and we thank you for that. It reminded me of what I didn't know when God began to invite me many years ago towards the church, and that's the tremendous power and strength there is in a community of believers. And I want to thank all of you in the most sincere way for the many ways, those of you that stood in line for far too long to express your kindness. So thank you for all of those things. I'm confident today that my mom's gain exceeds any loss or grief that we're wrestling with. And because of that, I have enough hope to persevere. And I felt like I needed to honor her life a bit, and I want to do that as a part of this message. But I also feel a tremendous responsibility to take our faith and address what's happening in our world. If my mom could say one thing to you today, I'm pretty confident I know what she would say. I've watched just a little bit, not much, the last two or three weeks, maybe 10 minutes of some of the Olympic trials, getting ready for the Olympics, and seen a little bit of track and field, and you watch those relay races. It's amazing to me, the gifted athletes and the tremendous training and strength, but there's that critical point in those races where they put their hand behind them. And everything rests in the balance at that point. I tell a story, I've told it many times, about a French Olympic team. They were leading in their event, and they dropped the baton. And all the training and all the years of effort and all the lifetimes, all of it went away in the fumbling of a baton. Well, if everybody will just imagine you're putting your hand behind you, Miss Betty's putting a baton in it. Now, that's the good news. Now, for the rest of the story, and it's just because I've known her longer than most of you, she's going to ask you how you did with it. So you better run like she's chasing you. Ah, what a privilege to have godly people join us on our journey. You know, we have seasons together. I think we always imagine that we'll always have these opportunities. We'll always be able to open the doors of the church and come when we want and gather when we want. And the things that we like and the things that we want to do will always be available. I've had enough birthdays and watched enough now that I understand God gives us seasons. And it would be wrong to lead a presumptive life. I think we should take advantage, understand the gifts we have, cherish them every day, celebrate them every day. It's important because we're living in a season of tremendous turmoil. I want to point this, I'm going to keep pointing this back to the church, and by that I mean Capital Church, not this congregation. Folks, when the church fails, people suffer. I don't mean congregations or members. I mean when the church fails, broad groups of humanity suffer. I earned a degree in history, and I won't take the time to belabor it, but I can tell you when, you know, the Roman Empire became a Christian empire. Many holes in it, many flaws in it, certainly far less than perfect. But it was transformational what the gospel did to that structure of Roman law and organization. But when Rome fell and then Constantinople fell and that Christian worldview, that biblical worldview with all its flaws, when it collapsed, you know what happened? The Dark Ages. Civilization in the West regressed into demonism and paganism and violence and brutality. And it took centuries to walk out of that again. When the church failed in Europe in the last century, when the church lacked the courage or the will or the attention or for whatever reason, the church, it wasn't just the German church, the church across the West failed. And untold millions of people died. When the church fails, people suffer. We've been coached into this thing that governments protect us and organizations protect us and NGOs protect us and whatever. Folks, Almighty God is the one who watches over us. And the Church of Jesus Christ in the earth, when it's healthy and strong and vibrant and alive, withstands evil, provides a pathway for overcoming, illuminates things that bring dignity to those that would otherwise not have it, that protects those who would have no protection. Now, there are chapters where the church has failed. I'm not denying that. It's not difficult to find them. But when the church is the church, it brings life and hope and transformation to people. My question to you is, what's going to be said of the church in our generation? It's important. There's many voices today that say we shouldn't talk about our current culture, that we're being political. I disagree completely. I have a passing interest in politics because I believe politics in our culture is a reflection of the heart of the nation. In the same way, if you're in the hospital, they're going to take your vital signs on a regular basis. They'll check your blood pressure and your pulse and your oxygen levels. They want to know your health. And if they're paying very close attention, they'll do blood screens. Well, I believe elections are like taking the vital signs of the spiritual vitality of a nation in the one we have. We have a representative form of government. We have elections, and we vote against the sanctity of human life, and we vote against biblical views of marriage, and we vote against all sorts of biblical principles and values. It's not a political problem. It's a church problem. And then we compound that by saying, well, we maybe shouldn't talk about those things. Folks, it's who we are. The difference in applied science and theoretical science is engaging people. Now, science theory is important because it ultimately gets played out in the practice of medicine. But if we never take it out of the laboratory, it doesn't help the people. The same thing is true of theology. If we gather in our churches and we have debates about the nuances of theology, but we don't take that into our culture, we are robbed of the transforming power of the gospel. Now, I understand it brings confusion and even division. Jesus said that. He said, I didn't come to bring unity or peace. I came to bring division. And the goal isn't to be divisive. The goal is to know the truth, a biblical perspective, and then encourage people to bring alignment in their lives with that. So when we talk about a life that triumphs over evil, it's about a biblical worldview. But to do that, we have to understand what's happening in our culture. I came across a quote. It's not a new one. It's from a Lutheran pastor, a German pastor, Martin Niemöller. I suspect many of you have heard it. He wrote this, first they came for the socialist. And I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionist, but I didn't speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, but I didn't speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. The backstory makes a great deal of difference. That's not just a witty quote. As I said, Martin Niemöller was a Lutheran pastor in Germany. In the 20s and 30s, he was a very vocal sympathizer with Nazi ideas. He thought that nationalism was an appropriate response to the humiliation of what followed World War I. When Hitler came to power, Niemöller became a very outspoken critic because he saw the interference in the church from the Nazis. You should know he spent the last 8 years of Nazi rule in prisons and concentration camps. You see, there was a point in time where the church's response could have changed the outcome of history. It could have changed the destiny of the West. But it was either inconvenient or the price seemed too high or everyone was distracted. It was true amongst the Christian community. It was true amongst the Jewish community. I don't know that they would have changed the outcome, but they could have certainly changed their destiny. I've listened to interview after interview after interview with Jews from the European community who said, we never imagined the hatred would come for us. We were the presidents of banks. We were in charge of universities. Our families had been a part of the culture for hundreds of years. And you still hear the shock in their voices where they say, until that late at night when they knocked on our door and they took us away. When the church fails, people suffer. Our premium right now is a bit more personal to me. It's a book called An Extraordinary Life. It recounts how my parents came to faith, and it'll walk you right up to the point where they founded the congregation that I still serve. It's relevant to me right now because my mom recently went to heaven. Now, I'm walking through that. I'm grateful for the gain she's had. That helps me overcome the loss I feel. But what amazed me is we celebrated her life for several days were the voices that reached out all across Middle Tennessee. But beyond that, I had phone calls from Africa and Asia and the Middle East, multiplied thousands of people who raised their hands and say, because of that one person's faith, my life was different. Well, that's really the message I want to give you. It's the reason why I think this book has value. The title's An Extraordinary Life, but by from an outside perspective, really ordinary people, a veterinarian and his wife with a family, all the things that would go with that. They've impacted, multiplied thousands of people with the gospel. I've been watching Olympics and Olympic trials. I watch the relay races where they hand those batons one to the other. Here's my suggestion to you. You'll put your hand back. I believe the Spirit of God will put a baton in your hand so that you can make a difference. You can lead an extraordinary life. He's calling people now. I believe an extraordinary life will help you make a difference for the kingdom of God.
And so she said that the doctors came in and they said they want to do additional surgery. 6 months is probably all you have to live.
I prayed a prayer, and I know that did not come from me. It was a desperate cry, I thought, in dying. And it was God that gave me that prayer. And I put my x-rays back in the envelope, and I said quietly, you know, if God doesn't change you, it's not real. And I knew that somehow, but I couldn't voice it.
There was no answer other than I had my wife, I had my three boys. I knew where we were going.
In George and Betty Jackson's book, An Extraordinary Life, you'll get to know Pastor Allen's parents, and you'll find a firsthand account of how God can take an ordinary life and transform it into something extraordinary. Read about the encounter Miss Betty had with Jesus and the impact of a simple prayer. Use the QR code in each chapter and you'll find a video with Dr. George and Miss Betty sharing more of their personal reflections. When you hear the Jackson story, you'll see what God can do when you consistently choose to say yes to Him.
You may imagine that your life isn't extraordinary, but if you will yield it to Jesus, He'll write an extraordinary ending to what you think is an ordinary beginning. The book will be a strength and, I believe, an encouragement to you. Take the time to read it, open your heart to God, and just see what He has for you.
Request your copy of An Extraordinary Life when you donate $30 or more today at allenjackson.com or by calling 800-880-5102.
Well, you and I are witnesses to a conflict of biblical significance. It would fit right into the book of Judges when the people lost their way and God handed them over to a series of judgments. We see them all around us. If we just remember quickly, and I don't want to stand here long because I do want to get to the biblical response, but our experiences together from the last 4 years have been very insightful and very different than any previous experiences we've had. We faced a pandemic of unknown origins. China, the country where it originated, hid the facts from the world, denied it, did their best to cover it up, and never suffered any true consequences for the devastation they unleashed. Our churches, on the heels of that, were told to close, and we complied almost universally. We lost sight of a fundamental component of the people of God, and that's that in the face of great suffering, our assignment as God's people is to serve the suffering. Our schools were closed for many months. Then our children were masked. We know a bit about the outcomes now. It's begrudgingly kind of leaked into the public square. There's significant learning deficits that we're still struggling to overcome. Our hospitals and nursing homes were locked. The most vulnerable amongst us were left alone in a time when tremendous fear was being incubated all across our culture. In the face of a pandemic, doctors were sent home. Then there's all these random instructions that were issued as if they were rooted firmly in scientific fact. Cover your face, even if it's with a bandana. Maybe two. Stay 6 feet apart, social distance. Put up plexiglass, because plexiglass is the great destroyer of viruses. And then we saw things that I never imagined we would see. Censorship. The taking down of the freedom of speech. Censorship from an unholy union of social media and powerful technical companies in our own government. expressions of authoritarianism that set aside things in our Constitution that we once thought we protected us, clearly showed us those protections were more an imagination than a reality. And in the background of all those chaotic events and frightening information, we were undergoing an election process. It was just kind of running in the background. And in state after state and circumstance after circumstance, the rule of law was suspended because of pandemic concerns. People were encouraged to vote early and to vote often. Common sense was replaced by fear and propaganda. And ultimately, we witnessed in January 6th what we have been told repeatedly was an insurrection, a murderous attempt to overthrow our duly elected government. It was threatening enough to those in power in the Capitol building that they erected a fence encircling the Capitol building. It's worth noting that they refused to build a fence along our border while they invited invasion of millions of people. The details of that day are still not clear, but upon evaluation, we know this, that the only murder that day was committed by a Capitol police officer in shooting an unarmed woman. The facts have been pretty carefully hidden, while the media has relentlessly recited the propaganda. But it didn't stop. It hasn't stopped. This last October 7th, communities in Israel were attacked by Hamas and citizens from Gaza. Not just terrorists, citizens from Gaza. 1,200 people were brutalized and murdered. More than 200 hostages were taken. Many are still being held, among them American citizens. Across the Muslim world, there were celebrations which took place. In our nation, we've witnessed a rather stubborn reluctance to condemn the event and persistent demonstrations supporting Hamas and their self-declared goal of genocide of the Jewish people. But it doesn't stop. In recent days, we've witnessed an assassination attempt upon a former president and a leading candidate in the current election. Even casual observance suggests the attack was allowed to unfold. There's been little or no transparency from those in charge. Many in the media are now suggesting it was a political stunt and not a real threat. The excuses that have been offered, to be candid, seem farcical. The roof was too slopey. But it's a symptom of a much larger issue. A few months ago, I had the opportunity to do an interview with Robert Kennedy Jr. Some of you will remember that both his father and his uncle were assassinated. So Mr. Kennedy, at some courage on his part and great vulnerability, entered this current election cycle as a candidate and has been consistently denied until just the last few days the protection of the Secret Service. He was told to provide his own security if he wanted to engage in the election. We have a president who has called his chief political rival a target, and the media who repeated the label endlessly. Almost anything you want to pick up or look at, our nation continues to deteriorate at a rate that implies an intentional dismantling. It seems to be far too specific and consistent to be random. We defund our police and turn our military into a social experiment, asserting that preferred pronouns make us safer, or that women and men are equal in physical strength and stamina and therefore should be deployed equally on the front lines of battle. And then we hide things. The 4th of July weekend in Chicago, I just returned from Israel where I was told it was so unsafe. Then I'd traveled with dozens and dozens of people, and we'd had a wonderful time. I returned home to a weekend in Chicago where there was 100 shootings. And some of the reports were as many as 20 fatalities. Our cities are unsafe. Violence and homelessness is causing mass relocations. Our justice system has been weaponized, not against those who are committing crimes, but against those we want to keep from power. Our leaders choose to be energy dependent upon nations which are adversarial to our own national interest. Our economy is staggering, almost $35 trillion in debt. It's a number too big for me to understand. Inflation has changed how we live and how we imagine our futures. Yet we are told repeatedly by multiple voices that it's transient or it's the result of corporate greed, or we're suffering inflation and our chicken costs more because the super wealthy are not doing their fair share. And in the midst of all of this, for the most part, the church says, we don't want to talk about it. Well, I would submit to you, we have a spiritual problem. It's far more than anything you can evaluate in the political arena. We have a fundamental spiritual problem. So here's my invitation to you. Let's decide to become a part of the spiritual response. Let's decide. And towards that goal, I brought you a short course in confronting evil. And I say short course, it will be. We may elaborate in some future sessions, but for this morning, it's an introduction. Then I'll start with Matthew chapter 4 and verse 1. I'm back on your notes. There's hope. My God, 2 pages of scripture, and he's rambling off the path. Matthew 4, in chronologically, is just following Jesus' baptism and the descent of the Spirit and the public affirmation of Jesus. Nothing remotely like that in his life up to this point. The birth announcements were private, maybe the angelic show in the fields outside of Bethlehem with the shepherds, but there's been silence, and now Jesus is approaching 30 years of age, and he presents to John to be baptized in the Jordan, and the heavens open, and God speaks and says, "This is my son, I'm pleased with him." And now we step into Matthew 4, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And the tempter came to him and said, "If you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." And Jesus answered, "It's written, man doesn't live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." I would point out to you as a beginning point that first there's an affirmation of Jesus. God's not angry with him, frustrated with him. Jesus hasn't wandered from the path. He hasn't deviated. He's in the midst of what God has asked him to do. The Spirit descends upon him. He begins the public portion of his ministry. And the first response is the Spirit leads him into the desert where he's tempted by the devil. And the Spirit prompts him to an extended period of fasting. Our governor has prompted us to a month of fasting, gratefully not a full month of fasting. As a congregation, we're taking Wednesdays to fast and pray. If you haven't yet joined us, please do. It's an important time. And the devil arrives with a question for Jesus, and he says, "If you're the Son of God." Now, I think our beginning point from that passage and this initiation and to beginning to imagine what it would look like for you or for me to confront evil, I think we have to recognize the reality of evil and temptation. It's fashionable to deny it, to act as if we're above it. We're a little too sophisticated for the devil. Or we're a little too secure in our conversion to think that there's any real meaningful temptation. Because anything that would present itself, we could just say we're sorry for, and then we can be forgiven, and therefore it's kind of no harm, no foul. And so we've been given the imagination that spiritually we're bulletproof. That the redemptive work of Jesus is such a remarkable thing that there would be no consequence, there would be no diminishment, there would be no forfeiture were we to choose ungodliness. Therefore, we have diminished temptation to be something that other people struggle with, but for the most part, we live above it. There's a Greek word I would like to suggest in response. Don't get ahead of me. I might have learned a new Greek word. It's improbable. I think baloney still works. If Jesus faced temptation, the obedient Son of God, I think you and I would be incredibly arrogant or remarkably naive to suggest that we're not going to face temptation. It's a part of the journey. And just as affirmation, when the disciples asked Jesus to teach them to pray, they said, "John taught his disciples to pray. Won't you teach us to pray?" Jesus said, "Yes, this is how you should pray. You know the prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." Do you remember that line? Jesus slipped into that universal prayer that we've repeated so many times. "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one." You wouldn't need to be delivered from the evil one unless the evil one was in pursuit. You wouldn't ask to not be led into temptation if the reality of temptation wasn't real and we don't have places where the Spirit of God puts us in proximity. There are times when you confront evil, it makes you more vulnerable to temptation. We've spent too much time avoiding. So if we use Jesus as our pattern, I would suggest, secondly, we have to prepare for the truth to be challenged. The truth in your heart. I'm not talking about the truth in the culture. There's always going to be that battle in cultures between those who engage with and yield to the authority of God and those who don't. Our Bibles are filled with that, from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation. Revelation is the culmination of that with an Antichrist, this embodiment of that refusal to yield to God, and a high priest standing alongside of him with all the supernatural, but not under the authority. That battle's always going to rage in our culture. But I'm talking about within our hearts, within our homes, within our lives, this struggle. The truth will be challenged. Satan came to Jesus and questioned God's truthfulness and his faithfulness. "If you are the Son of God," he said. He does the same with us. And I would submit to you that one of our fundamental vulnerabilities is that we have a too great of a lack of conviction that God is really involved. Because we've pushed God off to eternity. We believe in a God of salvation, heaven maybe out there someplace. But where we live this week, we better fix it. We better have a solution. We better know what to do. So we don't really pray. We don't really invite God in. Not in a meaningful way, not in a purposeful way, not in a sacrificial way, because we think we better do something. And I'm talking about the church.
I want to pray with you before we go. Father, I thank you that you're the author and the completer of our story, that irrespective of our circumstances, you have written a future for us that is a display of your power and your strength and your great love for us. May that future fill our hearts. I thank you for it in Jesus' name.